John chapter 19, verses 38 to 42. After these things, Joseph of Arimathea, who was a disciple of Jesus, but secretly for fear of the Jews, asked Pilate that he might take away the body of Jesus, and Pilate gave him permission. So he came and took away his body. Nicodemus also, who earlier had come to Jesus by night, came bringing a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 75 pounds in weight. So they took the body of Jesus and bound it in linen cloths, with the spices, as is the burial custom of the Jews. Now in the place where he was crucified there was a garden, and in the garden a new tomb, in which no one had yet been laid. So, because of the Jewish day of preparation, since the tomb was close at hand, they laid Jesus there. At the end of John 19, after Jesus' death, secret supporters of Jesus, Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus, come and take Jesus' body away and bury it. Nicodemus is taking a risk at this point. He originally came to Jesus at night to avoid being seen, and he's already come under suspicion in previous chapters, but now he is doing something on a grand scale and more openly. None of the disciples, or even the women, seem to be here at this point. The women come later on. As in the other gospel accounts, they see where the body is laid and then they come to bring more spices. This is not the first time in the gospel, of course, that there has been reference to spices in association with Christ's burial. In chapter 12, Mary of Bethany anoints Jesus' feet with nard, and he declares that it's for the day of his burial. But yet, the spices that are brought here are fit for a king, and some have estimated they're even 100 times more costly than the nard used to anoint him. There are other accounts from the period of people bringing such costly spices for a burial, but this really stands out. This is the sort of thing that you'd have for a ruler of the people. And so he's being treated as a king of the Jews by these figures who are themselves rulers of the Jewish people. The purpose of the spices was not to preserve the body, but to cover the smell and to honour the deceased person. Now, there are spices and there's a garden. This isn't the word that we have used for the Garden of Eden, but rather it's the word that's more commonly used in the Song of Songs in the Septuagint. So if we go to a passage like Song of Songs, chapter 4, verse 12 to 16, we read, "A garden locked is my sister, my bride, a spring locked, a fountain sealed. Your shoots are an orchard of pomegranates, with all choicest fruits, henna with nard, nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with all trees of frankincense, myrrh and aloes, with all choice spices, a garden fountain, a well of living water, and flowing streams from Lebanon. Awake, O north wind, and come, O south wind, blow upon my garden, let its spices flow." In Psalm 45 we have another reference to myrrh and aloes, again in reference to royal lover themes. "Your throne, O God, is for ever and ever. The sceptre of your kingdom is a sceptre of uprightness. You have loved righteousness and hated wickedness. Therefore God, your God, has anointed you with the oil of gladness beyond your companions. Your robes are all fragrant with myrrh and aloes and cassia. From ivory palaces stringed instruments make you glad. Daughters of kings are among your ladies of honour. At your right hand stands the queen in gold of Ophir." So myrrh and aloes are connected not just with death and burial, but with these themes of love. The garden and the spices remind us, I think, primarily of Song of Songs. This is the king entering into his glory, and he's entering into this chamber from which he will come forth. He's the one who will open up the garden so that the living waters will flow out, a theme that's very prominent within the Gospel of John. He's the one who will let those spices flow out into the world as the wind awakes and blows them out, the wind of the Spirit. All of these are themes within the Gospel, and as we've gone through the Gospel, I think we've seen many cases where there are references to themes of love taken from the Song of Songs. Already we've seen that reference in Song chapter 1, verse 12, and the king at his couch and the nard filling the room with its fragrance. That's what's referenced in the act of Mary of Bethany. Jesus begins his ministry at a wedding feast. He's announced by the friend of the bridegroom. He is the bridegroom. He's the one who comes to the woman at the well and speaks about himself as the man who is to come. He's the true Messiah, the true bridegroom of Israel. He's the one who later will meet with Mary in the garden in another sort of marital themed text. And so I think we should see Song of Songs in the background here. Christ is the royal lover, and this is preparing his bed. This is preparing the room of the king, the room of the royal lover, the bridegroom that is going to come forth. Throughout the book of John, the glorification of Christ is focused upon his death and his burial, not just upon his resurrection. And so we should see in the way that the burial of Christ is described, these themes of glory. He's being buried like a king. He's being brought into this chamber, this garden that's going to release its spices, the living water, to fill the world and bring life to the world. But now it's charged with expectation. When is the bridegroom going to open this up and bring it out into the world? We might see faint themes of a birth event here as well, or setting things up for a birth event, but nowhere near as strong as they are in Luke. Luke will parallel the fact that Jesus is wrapped in linen garments, laid in a manger, and then wrapped in linen garments, laid in a tomb. There's a Joseph and a Mary at Jesus' birth, and then there's Joseph and Mary's at his death and resurrection. There are a Joseph and a Mary here, but yet the theme that is more prominent, I think, are the themes of love. And there are maybe themes of going back to the Garden of Eden, but I don't think that's primarily what's taking place here. The cross and the tomb are near to each other. They're very close by, and I think that highlights the connection between the two of them. These aren't detached things, but rather they belong very closely together. One question to reflect upon. We're told that no one was previously laid in the tomb. What other things in the gospel might this remind us of, and what significance could be found in the fact that this is a tomb for Christ and Christ alone?